Okay, so we're back for the afternoon session.
Yay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair. Hi, first line. Education.
I'm sorry. We have turned off the video because we're only recording and Tanya wasn't able to dial in, so everything's okay. My apologies for letting you know.
Okay. IFRS 9, an education session on new impairment fines. Fred.
All right, thank you. So.
And, sorry, Sue also.
Okay, so I'm going to kick off and I think Fred's going to talk about the disclosure package. Yes? So the background to this, as you may remember from the last CMAC meeting, was that Fred and I have been doing a whole round of outreach with investors on IFRS 9. Sell side and buy side, and we've done some round tables with analysts and then a number of one-on-one meetings with buy side investors, really trying to spread the word about IFRS 9, the expected credit loss requirements, and make people aware of what's coming to start educating the market. And so we thought it might be useful to do the same for you. So I'm not going to go through every slide in this slide deck, but we'll start off on slide 3. Hopefully you've got the slides in front of you. In terms of who's going to be most affected. Now, if you pick up IFRS 9 in the bespoke paragraphs, the new impairment requirements will apply to anybody who's got financial assets, so even corporates, but obviously the greatest effect of the new expected credit loss requirements is going to be on the banks. It will also matter to the insurance companies, although they say that often the portfolios of assets that they hold are high quality investment-grade bonds, so they expect the impact to be smaller. IFRS 9 republished in July 2014. It becomes mandatory from the beginning of 2018, allowing a long lead time for people to make the systems changes we expect that they need to make. And in Europe, before it becomes mandatory, we're still waiting for European endorsement. And the discussion we had this morning about the interaction with the insurance contract standard is relevant to that decision at the European level. Even though it's mandatory from 2018, you'll start to hear about it sooner than that for a few reasons. Firstly, people can early apply the standard if they want to. So, for example, we've already seen National Australia Bank started to apply IFRS 9 from October last year, so they're already applying the standard and providing the disclosures. And also, people are starting to provide information. And relevant to that is the work that the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force has done. I know Paul's a member of that, where they suggested best practice, and one of their best practice recommendations is that people should start providing disclosures sooner rather than later, not so much about the numerical impact of IFRS 9, although they recommend that that starts no later than 2017, but that people should already be starting to provide information to the market about their IFRS 9 implementation projects and how they're going to apply the model so that the market sort of builds up this information over time. And if you look at some of the recent financial statements that have been published by banks, we're starting to see some of those disclosures coming through. So you will start to see information about it. So that's the background in terms of China. The next thing I wanted to talk about, because I'm sure you all believe already that impairment's important for banks, and we can skip the papers and explain that, is sort of an overview of how the model works in IFRS 9, which is on page slide 9 of the slide deck. And I'll talk about the three-stage or three-bucket model that you may have heard of in a moment. But before I get into the three stages, I thought maybe it's worth setting the scene to talk about a couple of the high-level fundamental changes in the accounting for impairment under IFRS 9, if you compare it with what we had before in IAS 39. And the first fundamental change is that whereas in IAS 39 and other incurred loss models around the world, you only started to account for impairment once there'd been evidence of problems, a sort of so-called trigger event, and you waited until you had evidence of that event before you started booking impairments. Under IFRS 9, people are required to start accounting for expected credit losses right from day one, right from when they first lend money to somebody or buy a bond. They need to start accounting for expected credit losses. So there's no longer this delay in terms of the timing of when you start to do this accounting. So that addresses one of the key criticisms we had during the financial crisis, that all of the information came in too late. It's designed to address that. The other high-level difference between what's in IFRS 9 and what we had before is the information that gets used. So today, when people calculate their impairment amounts, their loss allowances under IAS 39, they have, in effect, a restricted information set that they are allowed to use. So even once you decide that you do have an impairment situation and you book loss allowances, the information that you are allowed or required to use to calculate your loss allowances is restricted to your historical loss experience and information based on current conditions. Even if, what people told us during the crisis, they expected things to get worse, they're not allowed to take that into account because it's a future expectation. Because people felt that that was one of the reasons for why the impairment accounting was so delayed in reacting during the financial crisis, IFRS 9 changes that and it tells people that they now have to use all reasonable and supportable information that they have available and when they calculate expected credit losses, take into account not only historical loss experience and current experience, but also the effects of things that they expect to affect the credit risk of the assets they hold over the life of those assets. So there's a forward look, which is a significant change as well. So that's the background. Now in terms of the detail that's then in the model, one of the key things that we have in IFRS 9 is this distinction between when you book the full expected credit loss on an asset and when you only book a part of it. And what IFRS 9 does is it focuses really on how assets are performing from a credit risk perspective relative to what the expectation was when you first lent money or originated the loan. If the asset is performing the way that you expected it to based on its credit quality when you first lent money, we only require a portion of the total expected losses on the assets to be recognised, a 12-month measure for performing assets. That's updated every period, even if you continue to say it's the asset's performing as you expected, you update for current expectations, and you do that 12-month measure unless and until you have evidence which shows that there's been a significant increase in the credit risk on the asset, so that you, in effect, consider it to be underperforming relative to what you had expected at the time that you first lent the money. Once that significant increase in credit risk occurs, then entities are required to book the full lifetime expected credit loss on those assets. We have another stage, which is in this model that's shown on the page, stage 3, which is for actual non-performing loans, and these would have been credit-impaired loans under IAS 39. For those assets, you still have a lifetime measure, maybe a bigger number because the loss probability is higher than if it was just underperforming, but it's still a lifetime loss allowance. But the difference between stage 2 and stage 3 is that when interest revenue is calculated, when it gets to stage 3, you apply the interest rate, the effective interest rate on the loan, to the carrying amount net of the loan allowance, rather than on the gross carrying amount, which is the case if you're in stage 1 or stage 2. The other thing that I'll say about the model before I open and see if you've got any questions is that you can see at the bottom of the page on slide 9 there's an arrow with two heads. That's because it's a symmetrical model. Things that get worse can get better again. So you can have things that move from the lifetime measure back to the 12-month measure again. If you would conclude that there's no longer been a significant increase in risk compared with the initial credit quality when you originated your asset. So that's the model in a nutshell. Does anybody have any questions on the model before I go on? Glenn?
Yeah, my question, since we're now using all available information and a forward-looking model so we're going to start with the book that's booked originally at cost and then the impairment model comes in. What difference do you expect that these answers will give relative to fair valuing the assets?
Good question. I think there's two key differences. Firstly, if you have a change in the fair value that's caused by something like interest rates generally in the market, that wouldn't be recognised in your expected credit loss, but you'd expect it to affect the fair value. So rates fell, that would affect the fair value, but not necessarily the expected credit loss, at least not in the same way. And the second one is that in terms of the perspective that's used when you come up with the numbers, fair value measurement is always the market, market perspective of the fair value. IFRS 9 says it's management's expectations of expected credit losses. So while we are very clear that you can't ignore market information, and we'd be expecting you to explain why you think something was perfectly fine if it was trading at 50 cents on the dollar, ultimately it's for management to support their judgment of what's reasonable and supportable rather than to, you know, conform with market prices.
Okay.
So those are the two key differences.
I have a question on the stage three. Clearly, that the corporate to stage two, as you said, that the lifetime ECL should be much higher than the at stage three than stage two, which will mean that the interest rate revenue should decline quite substantially from stage three two to stage three. But the my question is that the presumably that the for stage three portfolio, the I assume that there are so many customers who are, you know, stopped to pay any interest rate, interest.
Yep.
Even in that case, this model incur interest rate, interest revenue, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, yes, and that's actually an important difference from where the FASB are in terms of history and their new model that they're going to publish shortly. Under IFRS, both under IAS 39 and under the new requirements, there's no concept of non-accrual. Because we always do the calculations on a present value basis, we take into account the fact that you weren't expecting to get paid when you work out the PV of the shortfalls and cash flows to calculate impairment, but we wouldn't actually stop accruing interest. But because we did think that at the point where something's actually a bad loan, it probably is more representationally faithful to reflect that in the amount of interest revenue that's calculated. That's why we switched the calculation to be based on the net carrying amount rather than the gross carrying amount. But you're right, even if you weren't collecting interest and you didn't expect to, you'd build up a bigger allowance balance, but you would still be recognising interest. So it's sort of in two places at once. Like it's a sort of perfect NPV model, if you like.
What happens if you own a performing loan? It starts non-performing, and you sell it and you buy it back. Then it starts to be a performing loan again?
That's a good question, sir. Well, firstly, you need to be able to treat it as a sale. So depending on how the transaction's structured, you might not even be able to treat it as a sale in the first place. But let's assume you've managed to treat it as a sale and you've recognised a new loan.
Yeah.
Then when you sell the asset, you'll crystallise the loss on the old asset. So that will be booked and recognised in P&L. And then you'd start off with your new loan. That new loan would typically start as a new loan that we would expect to be the price you would pay for it would mean that you've adjusted the return on that asset to reflect its higher credit risk. So the model would typically say now you start again with a 12-month allowance balance for that asset. It's now got a different pricing on it, so it's different to the asset that you had before. Having said all of that, we do have the concept in IFRS 9 that if you purchase a credit-impaired asset, then for those assets, the normal model doesn't apply, and you recognise the full lifetime loss right from day one by adjusting downwards the interest rate on the asset to reflect the fact that actually that's a problem loan right from the start. So there's a couple of ways that we can address it in that situation.
Okay, I think that's...
So if you've got a purchased credit impaired asset, you have a lower interest that's calculated right from the start. And you always then have to recognise for that type of asset, which hopefully is a small population, but for that type of asset, this whole stage one, stage two, stage three doesn't really exist. You always book the whole lifetime expected credit loss on that asset because it's a bad thing right from the start.
Good.
So, but that doesn't mean that every poor quality asset is treated that way. It was more because you said it was a problem asset, so it's a similar. On slide 10 of the slide deck, we've got a slide which is relatively unusual to explain a standard that we've finished, which is explaining what we didn't do and why, but it's in here for a very particular reason, and that's because we got to a different place than the Americans, the FASB, on our expected credit loss model. So if you look at what the FASB is expected to publish in the next few months, they also are moving to a more forward-looking model that uses all information, starts to account for impairment right from day one, like us. But the difference is, right from day one, they book lifetime expected credit losses on their assets. They don't have this sort of 12-month moving to lifetime concept that we have. And obviously, we would have been good if we'd been in the same place, so we thought very carefully about why we didn't think that was a better model. And sometimes when I talk to people, they say, well, that sounds simpler, so why didn't you just do that? Sounds easy. Always lifetime, why muck around looking at whether things have increased in credit risk or not? And there was a couple of reasons why we didn't go with a lifetime approach. And one of them was the fact that we think that when you originally price a loan, you price it, being a rational investor, based on the credit risk at inception, and therefore you've got a higher margin that's already baked into the whole value of your asset. So for us, booking a lifetime loss on day one and reducing the carrying amount of the asset on the balance sheet significantly, potentially, below its fair value, doesn't really, to us, provide the best information. So that was sort of a conceptual and information reason that was the primary reason for why we didn't go down that route. Also, when we spoke to investors when we were doing our outreach before we finalised IFRS 9, investors outside the US very much, as a general proposition, liked this idea of making a distinction between things that were sort of performing the way expected and those that weren't. They thought there was extra information content in having those different populations defined. And there was also some macroeconomic considerations that were taken into account. And if you hear Hans talking on the topic of this subject, he often uses the example of the risk that in bad times, if you were lending on a long-term basis in the market and you knew that you had to book lifetime losses on everything you originated, it would create a massive incentive to run down your loan book or shorten the maturity of the assets that you're originating in times of crisis when the market needs liquidity. Could encourage banks to actually turn off the lending or shorten its duration. So we're always also concerned about sort of potential unwanted, unintended consequences of going with that approach. So that's why we decided that this model that distinguishes between things acting the way they should, consistent with the way they should be priced, and those doing worse than what you expected, so performing in a way contrary to how you might have priced them, was a better model to go. The next thing I wanted to talk about was the possible impact of IFRS 9, because everybody really cares about how big is the effect going to be on the balance sheet of the banks. And so the next few slides have got some information about that. So on slide 11, we've got an estimate of the effect of moving to a forward-looking impairment model under IFRS 9 on various assumptions of what the magnitude of the change might be in allowance balances. And you can see that the effects can be quite big. Unfortunately, I can't tell you how much we think, how much the allowance balances of banks are going to go up as a result of applying IFRS 9, because even they don't know that yet, because they're still making their systems changes. But what I can tell you is that there's been some surveys and analysis done. A survey that's often cited is one done by Deloitte, where they surveyed a large number of their banking clients around the world, and they said they thought that allowance balances would increase by about 50%. Other analysis that's been done, for example, by Barclays, they did some analysis. They talked of a number in the region of sort of 35%. So suggesting that it could be quite a significant increase, but we're not quite sure yet. If you think, though, that it is around this sort of 30 to 50% increase of those estimates are correct. On slide 11, you can see that that has a pretty big effect in terms of balance sheet. If you look at the common shareholders' equity, so this is IFRS equity as opposed to reg capital equity, it would be a decrease in the region of about 7 to 12% on the shareholders' equity. But rather than the effect on the IFRS shareholders' equity, what everybody really is interested in is what the effect's going to be on regulatory capital for the banks, because that's the main constraint for them and their business. So is this going to have an effect on Tier 1 capital or not? And the answer to that, unfortunately, is that we don't know yet, because we're all still waiting for the Basel Committee to decide what they will do as a consequence of us changing from an incurred loss model to an expected loss model, and also what they'll do about the fact that we've come up with one version of expected credit losses and the Americans have come up with a different one. So they don't have a level playing field to start with. The Basel Committee are working on that at the moment, we don't yet know what the outcome will be. But the important thing, I think about in terms of what the effect might be is to start with what the interaction is between the accounting allowances today and how the Tier 1 capital ratios work. And some of you may already know this, so I apologise to you, but it's probably worth touching on slide 12. So slide 12 tries to summarise how the interaction works between the accounting account allowance calculation and the regulatory capital one in most Basel jurisdictions. So even before we published IFRS 9, the regulatory authorities were concerned that the incurred loss model was not forward-looking enough, and so they'd already done something to make it more forward-looking for regulatory purposes. So they'd asked the banks to calculate a 12-month expected credit loss allowance and to see how that compares with the accounting allowance. And typically what happens today, because we have an incurred loss model for accounting, is what's on the left-hand side of the page. In red on your slides. And on that side of the page, you can see that the balance sheet allowance that's been calculated under IFRS is only 200, but the banking regulators have said, using their rules, that it would come to an allowance of 300. So there's a shortfall of 100 of what the allowance is relative to the calculation the regulators run. Because of that, what the prudential regulators do today is they take that 100 off Tier 1 capital. So even though the allowance balance was 200, they've already taken into account the effect as if it were 300. Take a haircut from Tier 1 capital. What that means is if Basel were to keep those rules in place today, as long as the uplift in the allowance balance was within that range of 100, there'd actually be no net incremental effect on the banks because they were already being haircut for that extra 100 anyway. So the million-dollar question is whether the IFRS 9 goes above and beyond that extra 100. What the banks are worried about, though, is what's on the other side of the page, the blue column on your slide 12. And that's what happens under the current rules if you actually did a calculation where the accounting number was bigger than what Basel calculates. So you can see here that if you calculated for accounting purposes a balance sheet allowance of 300, you came along and applied the Basel requirements and they said the expected loss is only 200, you get the benefit of an add-back of the 100 of excess, but that add-back is only to Tier 2 capital and it's subject to a cap. Now obviously the banks aren't going to be very excited if we come along and make them book allowances which are over and above the Basel numbers if they get a credit for it, but it's only Tier 2 capital because that's not really very valuable at all to them. So the banks are very busy at the moment talking to the Basel Committee, explaining why they think it would be appropriate to introduce symmetry in this model in the context of us moving to an expected loss model. So they're trying to get the 100 added back to Tier 1 capital, and if they did achieve that, if Basel agreed to that, it means there will be no impact on regulatory capital of IFRS 9, because whatever we take off for accounting purposes, they always reverse it to get back to a Tier 1 effect, as if it was the Basel number that mattered.
That presupposes the Basel number doesn't change.
Yeah, I haven't heard them talking about changing the way they do that calculation. It's more about how it interacts with our number. Anything's possible.
Sure, can I ask?
Sure.
Is the regulator that judges whether there's sufficient regulator to capital available in a bank currently not that interested in the how do you say it? Are they fully banking on the at cost they're not probably. So do they not already take this direction into account in setting the bank-specific thresholds? So they know so much about those banks. There are general thresholds, but there will also be bank-specific thresholds given the quality of the book. We had an asset quality review. We had the regulators have lots of insight. So insofar this is a problem, isn't it more minute than say big numbers changing as a consequence of this because a regulator already looks past beyond
I think there's a few different schools of thought. One school of thought says that the regulators already take into account the credit quality of these assets, for example, when they come up with the risk weighting. So to now come along and take our impairment numbers on top of that is, in a sense, to them double counting. So I think that's more along the lines of what you're saying, that nothing's really changed, so why would there be such a dramatic effect?
Yeah.
I think the other school of thought is that the prudential regulators certainly pushed us very hard to move to a more forward-looking model and to move to a model which was very, I think from their perspective, the quicker we could get the people to move to lifetime, the happier they were. They didn't necessarily get it moving there as quickly as all of them would have wanted. But they're not unhappy with the prospect that allowance balances would increase relative to before. So some people think that this is potentially an opportunity for them to have another mechanism to increase the amount of capital the banks would need to hold.
Okay.
So I think it depends on where it falls on that spectrum, where we'll land. And it does matter a lot, because on slide 13, we don't have our Standard & Poor's representative here today to thank him for his data, because this is actually from Standard & Poor's. On slide 13, is set out some work that was done by Standard & Poor's to estimate what the effect might be, not just on IFRS shareholders' equity, but on tier one capital, which is what we the banks really care about. And you can see there why the banks are very interested in the debate that the Basel Committee are going through, because if indeed there were an increase in the sort of 30 to 50% range that people have been talking about, if you look at the Western European banks, that's a significant change in their tier one ratios. So that would mean that if you look at the 50% number for Western European banks, if they had 10% tier one capital before, this is taking them down to 7.35. So there's a big number.
Those are massive numbers.
Mind you, this was before some of them did some big capital raising, so it's probably a bit. But there's more to come on that front.
Those are so meaningful that if this were to go through, banks would potentially rethink how they would lend, and they would not kind of affect, say, restrict capital and choke off lending. And I'm not speaking on behalf of banks.
Yeah, I think it's true, and you can decide whether or not it's a good or a bad thing that. If this is the effect and it does affect tier one capital, banks are going to be far more aware of the credit risk they're taking on because of the effect it will have on their regulatory capital. And if you've got long dated, low quality instruments, it can have quite a big effect.
Wouldn't be a bad thing if they start worrying about long dated, low quality instruments.
That's why I said you can decide what you feel about that.
This is Janet Yellen's answer, isn't it? And someone said that this would make banks think again, but she said, well, I really hope it would.
Certainly if you talk to banks, one good thing I think which is happening is that there's much more communication between the pure financial reporting functions and the credit risk departments because of this standard. So I think there's a much more awareness across the organisation now of credit risk and expected credit losses. Which I think is a good thing.
Two observations. One would be that this kind of thing is great for the bond market, in some sense. Companies would just pursue, if this is that kind of lending. The other thing is, if it's more sort of mortgages and these kinds of things, it has arguably an economic effect as well. When you choke off capital to economies because of this, they can't grow and it has a structural change impact. I mean,
In fact, it's not that suddenly, because of this, the banks turn more risky, they are as risky as they are. It's just how transparent do you make the risk to the investor. So we can cry about the impact, but the impact is there. It's do you want to know or not? I mean, that's
just to sort of the concern has always been that that the change in regulation, the change in the scorekeeping, could have an impact in how the regulator deals with it, which could have. So it's sort of about it's that loop, but it's back to this question of if let's assume the regulator does their job properly,
and they already do.
And they already do. So really what's going to happen is, really what happens is that if this shows better the risk that's there, and the regulator decides that given that new information, more capital is needed. I think that the specific concern was that some analysts have said that they would have to almost have to look at the change in numbers, factor in whether the regulator was going to add more capital before they could make the recommendation on the equity. That was the piece that sort of having to consider the regulator was, and that might be true at the beginning, but not maybe not at the end.
It shouldn't be our concern, because the regulators have the capacity to force the banks to raise equity if they need to. So it's not the accounting standards. Just have to. I agree with you totally. It just presents a picture. The regulators think there should be more equity to avoid banks deleveraging their balance sheet. They can force them to raise equity, like the U.S. did in 2009.
I cannot imagine that a company that, according to IFRS 9, is going to get a hit of 5% in their Tier 1, that the regulator currently is blind to that, and they say, oh, you can pay dividends, you can do whatever you want, because nothing is going on, look at how healthy you are. Of course, I assume that the regulator is doing his job properly to a decent extent.
So on before Hans says something that we on slide 18, I wanted to talk about the information that you'll see, well, we hope you'll see when IFRS 9 is applied relative to IAS 39. So on slide 18, we've tried to summarise some information that we obtained when we were doing the deliberations on IFRS 9 from the field work that we conducted in detail with some banks. And what we did was we took a sample of banks from around the world, we asked them to take real portfolios that they had, and we gave them a mock financial cycle, and we said, tell us what you think would happen to the allowance balances under these assumptions, and tell us what you think the numbers would be if you applied IAS 39, and what they would look like applying the then proposals. And this graph on slide 18 summarises that. Now, it looks a little bit scary because we, on purpose, created a very volatile profile, so don't think that this is what it's going to look like every year. Hopefully it won't. But it was really designed to see if IFRS 9 was truly going to be more responsive, because the main criticism we got on IAS 39 was it was just too late reacting to changes in credit risk information. And if you look at the slides, IFRS 9, based on our field work, is doing exactly what we hoped it would do. So if you look at the bar of IAS 39, first of all, and we're looking at a situation where we've got a worsening recession until you hit the peak, and then an improving situation, you can see that IAS 39 definitely did provide you with information that things weren't going well, but most of the information came in a year after things started to improve. So it showed it, but it was very delayed. And that's basically what we saw in the crisis. It sort of confirmed what everybody knew was happening. In contrast, the numbers that people gave us for IFRS 9, you can see that bar is moving in line with changes in expectations. So as things are worsening, allowance balances are building, and as they improve, they start to decline again. Now, the caveat is that this is sort of more perfect than reality, because they had the cycle information, so they could more perfectly track it. But it does show that we expect changes in expectations to flow through more quickly on a timely basis to show you changes in expectations.
Now, this is just confirmation, but the other things being equal, the total cumulative lifetime loss of IES-39 and IES-39 and the IFAS-9 is the same, right?
Yep, all comes
so
back to cash
this
in the
is,
end.
Yeah, this is just, I understand this is just illustrative purpose. So that this page 18, that it looks like that IFRS-9, under the IFRS-9, it incurs loss, recognized smaller losses than IES-39.
And the reason why is because it's not for the whole life of the assets, it's just a snapshot.
Yeah.
You're right, so
yeah.
It's a bit distorted.
That is, I want to confirm.
So what will happen in reality over the life of a financial asset,
mm-hmm.
there may be a different profile that will be booked, but it will come back, ultimately the net effect
mm-hmm.
will be whatever the cash shortfalls were.
But actually, under the IFRS 9, that clearly that the bank's management would get that their loan portfolio is at risk much earlier than
mm-hmm.
the IES 39. So presumably that they will change their behavior.
Yes, and that's
to become more cautious, right?
That's the idea. And some of the studies, one of the studies I had a look at, that the Basel Committee actually did some work and looked at research on this. Because people often ask whether this is pro-cyclical. And if you look at how Basel respond to that question, their response is because people respond more quickly to changes in expectations,
mm-hmm.
they can protect themselves more quickly. So they think it should actually protect rather than create better problems.
So that it will become less pro-cyclical.
Exactly. Yeah. Can I hand over to you, Frank, now to talk about?
Sure. So on slide 19, we get into introducing the topic of disclosure. We did a lot of outreach on disclosure requirements. And one of the key takeaways that we've tried to share with audiences when we've done this session is that it will hopefully clearly demonstrate to them what is driving the allowance balances between what you would call the business activity, so organic growth in the loan book, versus the changes in management's expectations. A key message that we tried to share with a lot of people in these sessions was that the way that the disclosure requirements are written, and it's a little bit summarized for you in slides 20 and slides 21, is to promote the force of market discipline. So really trying to help investors understand that the disclosure requirements are not spelled out as sort of a compliance checklist, but much more what we call objective-based, which is in line with the trend that we've had for disclosure requirements for other recent standards, such as IFRS 15. So just a little bit on slide 20. From a big picture perspective, the disclosure requirements are that you need to be able to enable your investors to understand the effects of credit risk on the amounts of future cash flows and the timing and the uncertainty of those future cash flows. And then that gets broken out into a few broad categories. So it should translate into more disclosure, not just around the amounts related to expected credit losses, but also the judgments and the estimates that management have applied in applying the model, and in also what is sort of informing the model, so the assumptions that they're using. And when we jump to slide 21, we have a few points there that we highlight that we know from our outreach were very sensitive to many of the investors that provided us feedback, such as on the fourth row, modifications to contractual cash flows, which is very sensitive to the issue of forbearance, which we know for those analysts that follow the banking sector closely has been an area where they felt as though there were informational deficiencies, especially in the post-crisis period. And so hopefully what we can see in the future, when you try to read the narrative and you try to really understand the bank's approach to credit risk management, a reader of those accounts will really gain a lot more insight into how the bank goes about managing its credit risk. And then key highlights on our discussion about disclosure are the tables. There's much more guidance in the standard about reconciliations. And on slide 22, you sort of see the centerpiece reconciliation that relates to the impairment model.
And that is showing you from the start of a period to the end of a period, the allowance disaggregated across three major categories. And so in there, that's really where we're hopeful for analysts to be able to understand what are the forces of change in volume of the loan book between new lending and disposals, and what are the forces coming from management's changes in credit risk expectations, and how that results in into transfers between the three different categories. So we think disclosure in this tabular format, accompanied by a very healthy, detailed narrative about how the bank applied this this model, is something that hopefully can give investors great confidence that the governance around how the model is applied and how it's all being, I guess, internally controlled is reassuring and is a step up relative to what investors have been accustomed to seeing disclosed in the past. On slide 23, we have something that's taken from one of the illustrative examples. It isn't a requirement, but it's more of a best practice. And so one of the reasons we do include it in the slide deck is part of promoting the whole message of market discipline when we speak to investors on the buy side and on the sell side. And that's, I think, in order for an analyst to really get the power out of the disclosure on slide 22, they would love to see the accompanying gross carrying balances of the loan book across the three categories that we see depicted on slide 23. And so far what we've seen for the banks that have done early application of IFRS 9 is this is an area that we haven't seen disclosed yet. So it's one for investors to continue to try to be pushy about. That kind of wraps up what we had on disclosure. I just also wanted to just say a thank you to Glenn. Glenn and Steve Cooper participated with myself and Barbara at another investor event that we hosted on IFRS 9. We had a very successful period of meetings, as Sue mentioned, with many buy-side investors and with the sell-side on a few occasions. And it seems to be a model that worked very well for us, and we expect to repeat on IFRS 16.
Questions? If not,
am I right in thinking that you would expect that the day on which a financial institution makes a loan, it would be booking some kind of allowance depending on its perception of the riskiness of that loan? So, from the start.
From the start, the reality is because they only report it, every half year or whatever, they might only book the journal entry on that day.
Yeah.
But as soon as you see financial statements, there should be an allowance balance attached to every asset that's there.
Right.
They certainly need to think about what the credit risk was on that day, because that's what the anchor is for all of these decisions about whether you're a 12-month or lifetime.
So just let's walk me through this. In IAS 39, you'd have your held maturity asset, which probably wouldn't have had any kind of impairment on day one, regardless of the riskiness of that. So if you were lending to subprime as opposed to prime customers, you probably have zero balances on your allowances. Now under IFRS 9,
could have at least a 12-month allowance.
You must have a 12-month look on at least on the subprime. Yeah. You might not have it on the prime, and that would make the recognition that somehow you're engaged in
even if it's prime
high risk asset.
Even if it's prime, they should have a 12-month allowance. They may calculate that allowance as being zero, but they can't not think about it that way.
Did you also say that the lender or the banker would have the ability to revalue or change its expectations that expected such and such loss, but over time those losses didn't manifest themselves, so they could sort of revalue?
Back to 12 months.
Yeah.
So you might say
there's a little bit of earnings volatility, I suppose.
Yes, but only if there's a real change in expectation. So we hope it reflects economic reality rather than being accounting volatility.
And just on that question, if you go back to slide 9, probably the most popular question that we fielded when we discussed the model had to do with the assessment of a significant increase in credit risk. So analysts were really trying to understand what the guidance in the standard spells out there. So we often discuss with them the fact that there's 16 pieces of information that management could sort of examine in order to determine that whether or not they were observing a significant increase in prevalence.
Two final questions or comments. Goro?
Yes. Could you tell me a little bit about the IFRS 9's disclosure requirement and the EDTF Enhanced Disclosure Task Force recommendations?
Sure. So, as I'm sure Fred said when I went to get my cough lozenges, the disclosure objectives that we've written in the standard are very much objective-based. So what we've done is we've said you need to provide information that satisfies particular needs, so particular things are understood, so for example, how the amount of the expected credit loss was calculated, and then we've got some suggestions of how you might meet those requirements. Now what the EDTF has done, I feel a bit nervous speaking on behalf of the EDTF, Paul and Drew, but what the EDTF has done I think is very much complementary to that, because they've talked about two things. Firstly, they've talked about what they think would be good disclosure up until when you actually apply IFRS 9. Mm-hmm. So talking about what's your project, mm-hmm. where are you at in the project, that sort of thing. Then they talk about what they think would be good practice post-application of IFRS 9. And I think a lot of their suggestions in there about what good disclosure would be, for example, about information about probability of default tables and that type of thing, I think could very much be used to meet the disclosure objectives in IFRS 9. Mm-hmm. So even though the EDTF recommendations are recommendations and not generally mandatory, and even though they're separate to what we have done, I think the EDTF were quite good in terms of working with us, so that we've tried to make sure that rather than being duplication, that could actually be a way of meeting some of the requirements in IFRS 9. But I think some of their things in there will really help get even further behind the numbers than what we've got in IFRS 9, because the EDTF is very much written with very sophisticated large international banks in mind, whereas we've got requirements that need to sort of apply to everybody. But I see them as being complementary.
Finally, Dan.
Yeah, I had just a quick question. On the day one credit loss issue, am I correct in assuming that that just gets booked right to the balance sheet? In other words, there's no P&L impact? Or is there a P&L
impact?
P&L.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
Debit expense, credit allowance.
Okay. I thought it went on at the net value, but it doesn't.
Okay. Great. Now I can improve my time.
Right.
So let's move to the next session.